Good afternoon, everybody. It gives me great pleasure to host and chair this very important and very timely event. My name is Tomila Lankina. I'm a professor of international relations here at LSC, at the Department of International Relations. And it gives me great privilege to chair this panel of distinguished speakers whose expertise and roles span both academia as well as policy and indeed government service. And so they're uniquely placed to talk about the changes and debates about the defense and security architecture in Europe as these horrific events and the war in Russia's war in Ukraine unfolds before our eyes. Let me just introduce very briefly each speaker now, and then I will open the floor. But first, I'll also give a couple of remarks from my own perspective as a political scientist who has worked on Russia for quite some time. So our four distinguished speakers are Tanya Latic, who is a policy officer at the European External Action Service. Our second speaker is Dr. Mykola Gnatovsky, who is at Taras Shevchenko National University of Kyiv, an advisor to the foreign minister of Ukraine. Our third speaker is Dr. Simona Suare, who is a research fellow for defense and military analysis at IISS. And we also have as our fourth speaker, Dr. Robert Ondrejczak, who is the Slovak ambassador to the UK. Each speaker will have about 10 minutes, and then we will open up for Q&A. And I should note that our first speaker would have to leave at 6 o'clock sharp. So hopefully we'll have, you'll have a chance to ask her any questions, and she'll have a chance to answer them before she has to dash off. We're all extremely busy and kind of dashing on from one event to the next these days. Let me begin by offering some remarks from my sort of wearing the hat of a political scientist who has worked on Russia. I'm neither an expert on European defense and security, nor am I sort of a classic foreign policy specialist. I'm somebody who's analyzed Russian democracy, or rather what has been progressively kind of debased and diminished over the 20 plus years of Putin's rule. And as a political scientist who studied the Russian opposition movement, civil society, protest movement, I have been writing academic papers, blogs, including policy-oriented publications, kind of raising alarm bells, along with other political scientists who work on Russia, about the war that Putin has been waging against his own people. But unfortunately, in Europe, a kind of tacit consensus emerged over the years of, well, we can do business with Russia. It is an autocracy, but you know, Europe can still prosper and there can still be security. Well, we've seen now that that approach just does not work. There can be neither prosperity nor security, but if we help perpetuate or do not significantly challenge autocracies like Russia. So we're seeing now the kind of security implications of that approach. And what is really heartening to see is the amazing and incredible show of European and transatlantic solidarity with Ukraine. And this solidarity has come about in the face of these events. And that is something that perhaps we should also discuss in the Q&A, that yes, it is a story. We should focus on what Europe and the West can do in terms of defense and bolstering security architecture. But we should also talk about normative questions like sustaining and helping and enabling democracy to flourish in countries like Russia, because ultimately, European states are will suffer from this kind of erosion of democratic values in political regimes in their neighborhood. So I will stop there and give the floor to our first speaker, Tanya Latic, who is a policy officer at the European External Action Service. Tanya, the floor is yours.
Thank you very, very much. I hope you can hear me well. Well, first I want to say thank you very much for inviting me. I'm super glad to be here. I think the timing and the scope of your event are both really spot on. This event, I think, is asking the very questions that EU, NATO, and G7 leaders are asking and trying to answer themselves today in Brussels. Now, I'm speaking to you today from a hotel room in Paris. I've escaped a bit the symmetry in Brussels, but I will still give you a Brussels or an EU perspective on the questions that we're asking today. So focusing quite a lot on threat assessments and on the new security landscape that we have in Europe. And also, I think this is very timely because the EU has just adopted its strategic compass. EU foreign and defense ministers just on Monday have adopted the strategic compass, and EU leaders are set to endorse it tomorrow. So again, very, very timely. And this is also what I'd like to elaborate on today. Now, first, for those who are not EU nerds, I would also like to very briefly explain what exactly is a strategic compass. The second, I'd also like to explain why it matters, why it's crucial for our threat assessments and for setting the direction of the EU security and defense policy. And then third, I will also touch upon how the war in Ukraine has impacted our security and defense strategy. So to begin, what exactly is a strategic compass? In a nutshell, it's a strategic document that sets out a vision for the EU security and defense policy in the next 5 to 10 years. And what's special about it is that it sets concrete goals with over 60 actions and with timelines to deliver on this vision that it has put forward. And the starting point for having such a strategy in the first place was that the EU is facing increasingly complex threats. And that, well, the most effective and the most efficient way of responding to them and dealing with them is by acting together. And the whole process has started in 2020 with a very first step being a threat analysis. So this is, I think, particularly relevant given the questions of this event. And it's a big deal for us, at least. It's a big deal, first, because it is an objective, intelligence-based analysis, an assessment made of a compilation, if you will, of intel products and intel analyses from each of the 27 intelligence services, providing an assessment of our medium to long-term threats and challenges, the threats and challenges to European security. The crux about it is that it's objective and intelligence-based and not political. So it has not been touched by diplomats who are negotiating commas and synonyms and what wording. No, it is objective. So that's the first reason why it's important. The second is that it's the very first time that the EU does something like this. We haven't done it before, but it will certainly not be the last. Member states have been extremely positive about this, and we've already actually started slowly working on revising the threat analysis that we've done in 2020, because obviously a lot has changed since then. So this threat analysis, to contextualize a little, was the starting point of the process, and it sits at the basis of what we call the strategic compass. And in a nutshell, the compass is our security and defense strategy that provides this shared assessment of our threats and challenges and sets out these new ways and means to become, for the EU to become a stronger actor in defense. So that was on the compass. Second point, why does it matter? Why exactly is this compass important? Well, the EU has been working, I think, quite hard, especially since 2016, to develop its posture as a security and defense actor. And with the strategic compass, the idea is to bring all of these different strands and achievements that we have had in the past years, to bring them all together, to form a reflex of thinking strategically at the EU level among EU members, and to make the most out of the EU framework. So what is the added value of doing things in defense at the EU level to scale up everything that we've done so far? Now, we've had security strategies in the EU before, it's true, and to be frank, they haven't amounted to much in terms of delivering concrete capabilities and results. So this time around, our ambition is to make it count. Obviously, no one needs yet another policy paper for dust collection, that is clear. So this is where I think the compass is different and why it will be different. it's actionable. It has concrete deliverables with these 60 plus actions that I've mentioned. It has concrete deadlines, and perhaps most importantly, the fourth reason is that it has political ownership, adopted by ministers and endorsed at the highest possible level. This is the most political ownership you can get for such a document. The compass is structured across four main pillars, if you will. I will briefly outline them. The first pillar is called ACT, and it looks at our ability to quickly and more robustly be able to react when crises erupt. So it's focused very much on crisis management. The second one is called SECURE, and this looks at how to guarantee the EU's access in what we call contested strategic spaces, and basically everything that fits under what we call now the large umbrella of resilience goes into this chapter. The third one is called INVEST, which looks at spending more and spending better on defense, on tech, on innovation. The fourth chapter is called Partner. And as the name suggests, it looks at how to better tailor our partnerships and think more strategically about our partnerships. And these are the four main axes that outline the actions that the EU needs to do to respond and to adapt to this new threat environment that it is facing in the next year. That was on the compass and on why exactly it's important. The third point that I wanted to make here, and this connects a bit more to what Tonina has just said in the introduction, how exactly has Russia's invasion of Ukraine impacted the compass? Well, in short, obviously a lot. It has impacted it a lot. It's impacted a lot, particularly when it comes to the diagnosis of our strategic environment and the long-term perspective of our strategic environment. Russian tanks were obviously not only advancing in Ukraine, they were also very much trampling on the European security order as we know it. So the compass is certainly not shy in diagnosing this and in calling it as it is. It's a tectonic shift in European history. That's what it is. The compass very clearly recognizes that Russia is a long-term and a direct threat to European security. It's there, black or white. So the impact is clearly felt there, but on another dimension, I think the impact was also felt in terms of the urgency that Europeans felt to deliver on these 60 plus actions that we propose in there, and to demonstrate through that our resolve and our unity, which was again mentioned. And in this context, I think I must also join the list of EU officials, which you may have heard in the past weeks, mentioning the huge milestone that has been achieved with our actions under what we call the European Peace Facility, which is kind of a special pot of money that the EU has set up, which is running since 2021. Over a very intense weekend, a couple of weeks ago, just under 24 hours, and I can testify to that because I was also working on that very weekend, the EU has agreed to provide 500 million worth of military equipment to Ukraine. This was a huge taboo that was broken, something that the EU hasn't done before, and something that in normal times would have taken months, if not years, to approve. And just yesterday, again, very timely, the EU has agreed to double that amount, so to provide 1 billion worth of military support to Ukraine. And that is just on the military side. I'm saying this because I think the overall tone, vision, and ambition for what the EU can achieve in defense has changed as a result of that. And I'm trying to be a bit careful here to not sound too self-congratulatory. I think that's a bit of a danger here, because I think the circumstances under which this occurred have to be remembered, and they are truly horrific. So I think we have to also be a bit careful about our language. Now, to conclude, besides telling you about the compass, I think so much has happened in these past weeks that it's a bit difficult to truly comprehend these tectonic shifts, as we call them, that have taken place, and to make proper sense of the long-term implications that they bring for European security. I've already mentioned the historical decision on the European Peace Facility, which again is only military aid. The EU has done unprecedented stuff when it comes to macro financial assistance, sanctions, humanitarian assistance, and refugees. Purely on the military side, next to the European Peace Facility and the military support we have given, the EU has taken a forefront role in coordinating the brunt of the military aid provided to Ukraine, not only by EU members, but by NATO members as well, by NATO nations, by the United States, by Canada, by Norway, by the UK, and also by New Zealand, Korea, and so on, several other partners. The EU is doing this, which is, again, a role that no one would have really thought of before for the EU. So again, something that we have to reflect about. What does that tell us about our ambitions? We saw Germany making the headlines over a huge U-turn in defense policy. We're hearing about Denmark rethinking its opt-out in EU security and defense policy. We see Finland and Sweden seriously considering their NATO membership. And we also hear Ireland holding a national debate on their neutrality. In a nutshell, these are tectonic shifts for European security. That's what I'm trying to say. And I think this is why, for EU members, a strategic compass now is more needed than ever. And I don't think this is an overstatement. So I'll leave it at that. Hopefully that gave you a bit of some ideas of what we're trying to do in the EU. And I look forward to your questions. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Tanya, for a very thought-provoking kind of set of comments, which I'm sure will have lots of questions and will kind of stimulate a good discussion at the end. Let us now move on to our second speaker, Dr. Mykola Gnatovsky, who is at Taras Shevchenko National University in Kiev and advisor to the foreign minister of Ukraine. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much for giving me the floor, and I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me to participate in this very, very important discussion. However, I feel a little bit alien or foreign here because, as you know, I'm a lawyer and I'm an international lawyer, and I represent a profession that might be a very sad one these days, when the very basics of the very foundations of international peace and security, which are based on international law, have been so brutally violated by the Russian Federation. On the other hand, of course, the reason why I recently joined as the Foreign Ministry of Ukraine as a special advisor to the minister is because international law remains one of the main avenues of response for international law to these to this terrible war, and actually to in trying to look for solutions to these very new threats which this today's webinar is about. And I was very impressed by the presentation of the previous speaker, because I think indeed the response from the European Union has been unprecedented. It has been tremendous in many respects, as already mentioned, the efforts to help Ukraine with weapons, the efforts to, and the real, not just the efforts, but the real, very tangible help that has been received and will still be received. I'm sure about this, and also the European Union's reaction to the situation of Ukrainians who have been displaced and who had to leave Ukraine, trying to save themselves from the horrors of this war. This is an example of another absolutely unprecedented reaction, and of course, very importantly, the fact that Ukraine has already requested, has formally applied for membership in the European Union is something that is also revolutionary, and one would have never expected these to be happening so soon, only 4 weeks ago. So all of this is, of course, very positive and heartwarming, and the expression of solidarity, especially from the European Union and also from individual nations across the world, but primarily those who are members of the European Union, has been extremely valuable. So this would be sort of the positive side. But as an international lawyer, again, I have to say that sadly, what we see now in the strategic and defense landscape in Europe can be characterized from a lawyer's point of view as a complete inadequacy of the existing institutional also legal underpinnings, especially those which were created after the Second World War. The collective security arrangements have been utterly useless in reacting to the most egregious violations of international law and the biggest challenge to the international order, peace and security in Europe since the end of the Second World War. The United Nations mechanisms based on the Security Council, Security Council's almost exclusive competence in matters of international peace and security has proven to be hopeless. And I'm being slightly undiplomatic here, but it's obvious that the situation when there's an aggressor state who is waging an aggressive war, trying to destroy entirely and to deny the very the statehood and the very existence of a neighboring nation, is at the same time a permanent member of the European of the Security Council of the United Nations, capable of vetoing any decisions on substance under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, is essentially the this is the end of this. This is the end of this system. And I'm not speaking just as a Ukrainian. I think this system has been in decay for decades. And now the lack of any coherent response to this largely inefficient system has culminated in this horrible war of aggression that is being led by the Russian Federation against against Ukraine. As regards NATO, well, it's just today that the NATO summit was ongoing, and Ukraine's president was addressing it. I think it's also fairly clear that despite actions taken with a view to strengthening security of some of the member states bordering Ukraine, the overall response from NATO as an organization, I'm not talking about individual members, but the overall response has been disappointing and could even be interpreted by some as encouragement for the aggressor, which is most deplorable. So it that also raises questions now. As concerns are being raised of a possibility of Russia extending its military action to NATO member states, especially those which are assisting Ukraine with weapons, or those which are used for transit of weapons to Ukraine, such as Poland, for example. Then it begs the question when NATO will be finally ready to act. Is the fact of the nuclear blackmail by the Russian Federation sufficient to negate any security arrangement that has been in place in Europe and in the world since the end of the Second World War? Is nuclear deterrence about deterring collective security? It's not deterring wars; it's deterring security, and that is a major concern. The pre-World War II architecture in international law, strangely enough, is very much alive and kicking, and states still introduce individual countermeasures and collective sanctions against the aggressor state. The arguments of an economic nature are being used, and they are even if late, but still they no doubt they are efficient in one way or another. And as they're strengthening, I think it's clear that the clock is ticking for the aggressor. How long it is going to last? It is going to be able to withstand those sanctions. Of course, the very weak sanctions introduced after the 2014 beginning of the aggression and the illegal annexation or attempted annexation of Crimea and the occupation of two Ukrainian regions in the east of the country, they have produced an entirely opposite effect. They in fact encouraged the aggressor, because they finally which saw that they can, with this kind of response, they can easily cope. So this is another dimension to this, and I think the legal answers are very clear, and the legal answers provided by the UN Charter, by the inherent right of the state to individual, and I underline here, collective security is a perfect legal basis for any collective military action against the aggressor. There's obligations to prevent genocide. There's obligations to prevent other crimes against international law, which are also at play, which also provide a more than sufficient legal basis for any state which would like to fight alongside with Ukraine and which would like to restore international peace and security the most efficient way, namely militarily. So these are legal answers. There are not complicated. What is complicated is the security dimension. What is complicated is the political dimension, is the military dimension, and the response that could be produced to nuclear blackmailing of states. Because certainly, if one side at least pretends, or the aggressor at least pretends, that they do not care about the prospect of destroying the entire planet, they do not care, they don't seem to care about the prospect of nuclear winter and basically putting an end to the, not only to the civilization, but to mankind, then of course everyone else is at a loss what the response would actually be. And the responses which are being offered now, they appear to be one of the best possible responses, but then how much would you tolerate to before you do something more energetic? One needs a fully-fledged genocide. One needs more war crimes, like in Mariupol, in Kharkiv, and in Chernihiv, and in other major cities of Ukraine. One needs to wait until, let's say, the capital of Ukraine, Kiev, is razed to the ground, like Mariupol. What would be enough from the political and military point of view, not from the legal point of view, which is again crystal clear in my view. So these are open questions, and I think that efforts, including by the European Union, and as has just been discussed by Ms. Latici, to look for new instruments that would strengthen security is most welcome. But of course, there's more strategic solutions, and there's more urgent issues that need to be addressed before we actually have time to think about further strategies. Let me stop here, and I would be listening with great attention also to the following speakers, trying also to raise my own awareness of the dimensions that normally do not concern people of my profession. Once again, I thank you very much for this opportunity to express myself here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Natovsky, and also for giving us a very important perspective from international law and a legal perspective, which I think we should all sort of keep very much in mind when we discuss these important questions. We'll now move on to the third presenter, Dr. Simona Suare, who will give us a perspective on the sort of emerging new paradigms in European defense architecture. Thank you, Dr. Suare, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Professor Lankina. And let me start by thanking LSE and the Latu Forum for the invitation and obviously expressing my gratitude and what a wonderful opportunity it is to join you today in this discussion. Unfortunately, the context around the discussion, not quite so fortunate. So the question I think that was posed to us as panelists today was, well, how can NATO, how can the European Union create a security strategy that is effective in addressing the very many complex threats that we face? And my quick answer to that question is they can't, and that is the reality of it. It's only the member states acting together, including by using multinational platforms such as the EU and NATO, who can indeed develop such a strategy that can at least hope to address the threats we are currently faced with. But of course, Europeans in particular excel at developing strategy. Our last three decades are filled with breakthrough moments in which we put forward strategies. We've had a security strategy before. Where we lack, unfortunately, and for the time being, the jury is still out on the strategic compass as well, where we lack is implementation and follow-through. And that is really where the level of ambition is measured, especially if you're trying to assert that you want to compete, that you want to be a player in great power competition. It doesn't work just with words and papers. That's sort of my reading of history and the history of great power competitions in particular. Furthermore, I think that having a conversation among the member states about developing such a strategy involves not just a listing of the kind of threats that we are currently faced with. That is surely an important aspect of it. It comes with prioritizing them, linking them to means and ends. It also comes with a little bit of honesty to ourselves and to our citizens about which threats are new, including climate change and our efforts in that, including the technological revolution, and which threats are old, and calling them as old is important. Even if this comes with political accountability from the citizens as to why haven't you seen this coming sooner? This is where I would firmly put Russian aggression. This is the category where I would firmly put Russian aggression. And I think contending with that is incredibly important. So I think that to make the shift, to make the transformation that is required for us Europeans today to actually grapple with the kind of threat landscape that we are faced with, is to accelerate a little bit the learning curve that we have been through, we have been on for the past three decades. And to me, this learning curve has six steps. One could call them the six D's of European defense. And those are delay, deficiency, deter, defend, decouple, and develop. And they're not unique to Europe by any measure, or to contemporary history for that matter, but rather they're very much generally part of what historical learning curves are at the onset of great power competition and accelerating security dilemmas. And what I would say is, and to briefly go through each of these steps, is what I would say is, over the past three decades, Europeans have mostly been stuck on step one and two, delay and efficiency. European states have repeatedly postponed hard decisions about increasing defense spending, increasing defense investment, be it in procurement, be it in next generation technologies. And what we ended up with were very much enduring and now obviously important deficiencies in our military capabilities. And those have not stayed still, but actually in the greater context of Russian defense modernization and acceleration, in Chinese and Iranian investment in military technologies, they have actually started to grow. And what we've seen with the Russian invasion pattern, I would say, we've seen Russian invasion in Georgia in 2008. We've seen Russian invasion in Ukraine in 2014 and again in 2022. And this has culminated with, you know, bits of sovereign territory being taken apart, illegally annexed, or being left somewhere in the middle of some sort of testbeds for instability and conflict, if you'd like. And I'm afraid that we're not still at the end of that acceleration trend, and we might still see and be pushed into new concerning directions, be it the full loss of sovereignty by a member of the United Nations or escalation to the use of chemical and nuclear weapons on European territory, which would be indeed unprecedented. And that's not mincing words. And if this is not breaking the seal, I mean, I fully agree with Professor Mikola. If this is not breaking the seal of illegal and aggressive behavior from Russia's actions and us calling a spade, I'm not really sure what else would. But what does this mean for Europe? And in my view, what this means for Europe is that we are now finding ourselves in a position where we have to rush through the other steps of our learning curve about what it means to be in great power competition, to at least aspire to be a great power, or keep up with the competition more generally. And that means we need to really accelerate through deter, defend, decouple, and develop. And I'm not putting these in this order incidentally, but rather intentionally, and I'll explain why. So for me, the first thing to consider is whether the Europeans, and indeed the transatlantic alliance at this point, have actually been successful in deterring Russia from invading Ukraine and deterring Moscow right now from escalating the conflict. And objectively, the painful truth is that no, they haven't been successful at this. So one key aspect to consider, perhaps, is we're thinking about our strategy right now, whether in the European Union or in NATO, is how do we individually and collectively deter more efficiently? What kind of levers of national power do we need, be it advanced technologies, statecraft tools, geoeconomic tools? What kind of tools do we need to employ, and how can we employ them more efficiently against revisionist and aggressors such as Russia? What does this concept of modern deterrence that we need to, you know, develop look like, be it against conventional threats or hybrid threats indeed? And that is so intimately linked to our ability as Europeans to compete in great power competition. I would argue that right now we're not competing. We're posturing, we're signaling, but we're not competing. The second aspect that I would consider here is that we find ourselves as Europeans, yet again, forced by circumstances to defend ourselves and to try to help, to the degree that's possible, our partners. And as we transition to defend, to this step of defending, we see this in the pledges that individual nations have made to increase their defense spending. We've seen the same pledges in NATO and the European Union context. We've seen pledges to acquire new capabilities that are required for territorial defense. But the reality is that if we are as unlucky as our partners in Ukraine have been, unfortunately, we will actually be forced to defend with what we've got now. And this is where our treading our, you know, taking our time, delaying and allowing deficiencies in our military capabilities to grow will take their toll. Because the reality is Europeans are now under increased time pressure to develop the required military capability to meet not just the Russian threat, but a host of others. And I think that with Ukraine and what the unfolding situation in Ukraine now firmly in our sights, it's also worth asking whether our defense planners and decision makers are actually learning the right lessons from this conflict. Lessons about, you know, what to invest in to better prepare ourselves for the future, lessons about how to invest better in defense to prepare ourselves for the future. The third aspect that I would bring into the conversation is the trend that is very much accelerating now, at least in relation to Russia, of decoupling ourselves from our adversaries. And this is not just a result of choices in Moscow and elsewhere. I would say Beijing, Tehran, and elsewhere are definitely in the same category, but also through our increased transition to using sanctions as preferred tools that we can leverage against our adversaries for whatever risks and threats that are coming our way. And this, the evolution in the sanctions regime, the types of sanctions that we are now imposing, and the frequency with which we lever sanctions against potential adversaries certainly indicates a higher degree of tolerance among Europeans and other members of the international community, like-minded members of the international community, with this progressive economic and technological decoupling from our adversaries, without necessarily recognizing that this, you know, robs us of important leverage tools in the competition with them. And the final aspect that I want to underline here is develop. It cannot be understated or overstated, the fact that develop is key. The reason it's key is because we need it. We need to develop the military capabilities and statecraft tools that are needed to face a very different security environment that we have been used to over the past 3 decades. But what does this mean? We've seen investments, historical investments in Germany and elsewhere in Europe, pledges of increased defense spending. What does this mean? Where will it go? Are we trying still to plug capability gaps that we've seen unfold over the past 3 decades? Or are we prepared to invest smartly in new technologies that are going to give us an edge? Are we coming out of a mindset of meeting tanks with tanks, or are we trying to outsmart our adversaries? Unfortunately, because we are in a situation where we have to defend right now, this is limiting European options as to what it can invest in and what it has to invest in the short and medium term in order to be able to meet the minimum requirement of keeping its citizens safe. I'll leave it here, and I very much look forward to the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Soar. A very articulate set of concerns that we will be discussing in the Q&A as well. I'm sure there'll be lots of questions about some of the points you raised. I'll pass on now to the word to our final speaker. Mr. Robert Ondrejczak, who will give us a Slovak perspective on European defense and the evolving defense architecture. Thank you.
Thank you very much. First of all, thank you very much for having this opportunity to speak to you and to the distinguished audience today. I'm coming from, I represent Slovakia, which is a country at the very eastern flank of NATO and European Union. So we have quite a specific, or we are in quite specific situation at the time being. I just want to stress that those changes which we are witnessing now in European and transatlantic security architecture, they're not new. They didn't start 24th of February, but the roots are coming from 2008 when the Russians launched the offensive operations against Georgia, and in those times basically we were thinking that it's something which is at the periphery, strategic periphery of Europe or geographical periphery of Europe. And probably it's not a systematic change in Russian foreign policy and security policy, even though the Georgians were warning us. The next step was 2014, when basically Russia invaded Ukraine, illegally annexed Crimea and launched operations and war basically in eastern Ukraine, in Donbas, which basically undermined the basic pillars of the European security architecture. First of all, we are not using military force in order to achieve our strategic objectives here in Europe, and we are not changing borders by force. So, and obviously, the European and the transatlantic answer was quite strong, but I believe that not strong enough. So the Russian decision makers basically evaluated the situation that they can move forward, even though some countries in our region, or countries of our region, the Baltic countries, Poland, other Central European countries, Romania and some other countries, we were trying to say that there is a trouble, but we were called alarmist sometimes. So unfortunately we were right, and we are not happy about this. But now we are in a situation when we are witnessing the biggest conventional war in Europe after the Second World War, a war when tens and hundreds of thousands of soldiers are fighting with hundreds and thousands of artillery, tanks and other military equipment. So it's something which definitely has changed the European approach and also the transatlantic approach towards Russia. So everybody understands now that this is a systematic change, and this is a long-term change. So we are not going back to status quo ante, because simply it's impossible. And I'm very happy about the decision of the NATO countries today at from the summit. I'm especially happy because there is a decision about the creation of a new military presence in our countries. As you probably know, after 2014, in three Baltic countries plus Poland, the alliance established the so-called enhanced forward presence. But in Slovakia, Hungary, Romania, and Bulgaria, we didn't have any significant military presence from the allied states. Now it has changed, obviously. In case of Slovakia, basically several NATO members are deploying troops to our territory, namely Poland, Czech Republic, Germany, the Netherlands, Slovenia, and the United States, in a newly created, or within a newly created battle group, which will have approximately 2,000 soldiers. So this is one of the most important results that the alliance basically realized, or the member states basically they realized that this strategic gap and military gap which we witnessed in our region is unbearable anymore, and in order to be able to defend us in an efficient way, we need some military presence. So this is the first pillar which NATO and NATO members had to do. Basically, the second also a very important pillar is to help Ukraine as much as we can. Obviously, the help is being or the help is done in a, on a bilateral basis. Basically, almost everybody, almost every member of the alliance is trying to help Ukraine as much as we can. So, obviously, the most visible help came from the bigger NATO states, from United States, United Kingdom, but countries from our region provided very significant help if we transform it into per capita. So just another example, we provided anti-tank, anti-air missiles to Ukraine, ammunition to artillery, fuel, kerosene, and other military and humanitarian help. So this is second pillar what NATO did, and the third pillar basically that we try to raise the cost still for Russia for this invasion, and here not only the NATO but the EU played extremely important role by coordinating sanctions and economic countermeasures. I believe that those sanctions with the EU, the United Kingdom, United States and other allies from Japan, Australia and other countries basically introduced, so those sanctions will have a very significant impact on Russia's economy and society. Some economic analysts say that they will just push back Russia's economy by 20 years. Obviously, it's not a goal. It's just a tool to achieve strategic goals, and the strategic goal is to force Russia to stop this operation and aggression against Ukraine. It's very important to say that beyond those military and economic measures, there are other very important factors in wider Central Europe, and not only Central Europe but also in Baltic region. This is the change of the public opinion and the opinion of the societies in general. I can start from the far north, from Sweden and Finland, where the societies are more and more inclining towards NATO membership because they simply feel threatened by the Russian aggression and rhetorics, but also in our region, the supporters of active NATO membership just grew very, very significantly. Obviously, it's a direct consequence of having war next to our neighborhood. Just one example how close the war is to Slovakia. So some Russian strikes to Ivano-Frankivsk and other Ukrainian cities in western Ukraine were approximately or less than 200 kilometers from our borders, and one of the biggest cities in the very west of Ukraine, Uzhgorod, has an airport, and the airport is located just directly at the Slovak border, Slovak-Ukrainian border. So far, there were no strikes on this airport, but the runway finishes just 50 meters next to our border. So we really feel absolutely uneasy about this. And moreover, obviously, I mean, there is that humanitarian dimension of this whole war. I mean, millions of people, basically from Ukraine or Ukrainians, they just moved to towards the west or to mostly to Central European countries, to Slovakia. We offered shelter to almost 300,000 people. We are giving free healthcare, education, and other important things for relatively normal life, even though it's a very bad expression, obviously, because I mean it's very, very far from normal life if you need to run from the war. But we are trying to accommodate those people and to help them. And I know that the other countries in the region they are doing the same, especially Poland, where the biggest Ukrainian community is concentrated at the time being. So just to sum up and try to keep the limits, the time limits, this is a historical moment, and I understand, and I know that it sounds very it's very banal and very big words or something like this, but it's the biggest event, unfortunately, after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1998, with a very long-term consequence on European security. And we need to understand finally that this is a systematic strategic element of the Russian foreign policy and security policy, and there is very difficult to find a way back. And I'm quite skeptical if the opposite. I mean, I'm not even skeptical. I'm sure that under the current Russian leadership, it will be very difficult to find a way back to normal relations. And obviously, I just very much hope that Ukrainians will be able to fight and resist in such a heroic way as they are doing now, and our moral and strategic interest and goal has to be to help them as much as we can. Thank you.
Thank you very much for a very, very thought-provoking set of presentations. I'm aware that one of our presenters, Tanya Latic, has to leave in about 3 minutes. But if you do have a few minutes to spare, one of my questions actually relates to some of the comments you made. But if you have to dash off, absolutely, that would be fine. I'm aware that you're sort of time pressured. But I wanted to sort of slightly abuse my privileges of the chair and bring in some questions that will hopefully kickstart a discussion. And I think I could sort of place them all under umbrella of what Dr. Suare was discussing as deterrence. And these three sets of questions and comments are the sort of sanctions regime. And I wanted specifically to pick up on what Tanya was saying about the compass sort of rapid response and mechanisms, and whether the kind of very impressive and very quick reaction to imposing a very sort of wide-ranging set of sanctions that, frankly, a few of us expected of the EU to act in such a kind of efficient way in this instance, whether that is going to be an important part of the deterrence architecture and this kind of rapid response measures in the future, whether this is a model that they will consider. A second set of questions we haven't really talked about is energy security, because we know that the kind of energy dependence of some European states really weakened the possibility and delayed the sanctions and weakened the effectiveness of sanctions. So whether some of the speakers could talk about that. And a third set of concerns, which I would also bracket under deterrence in the future, is, and perhaps this is something that is in the area of international law and Dr. Gnatovsky would be expert to speak about, what legal consequences for perpetrators of war crimes. And so I just wanted to throw that in and open this up and give you a chance to respond before I pick up some questions from the chat.
Should I come in here?
Absolutely, okay. Please.
Perfect. No, thank you very much for everyone's presentations. Very, very insightful. Lots of thoughts that I wish I could share, but the time is unfortunately limited. So maybe a quick reaction to what you have said, Tonila, because I think you raise an important question that is a million-dollar question, and it's difficult to anticipate, of course. But I think, indeed, EU decision-making in responding to the war in Ukraine has set now a very high standard, indeed. What EU decision making is usually known for is the lowest common denominator, not very ambitious because of that, trying to, you know, to agree on the lowest common denominator that everyone, each of the 27 can agree on, because that's how we take decisions in the EU and foreign and security policy, by unanimity. However, as someone who is very dear to me has said in a different conference, indeed, we have the lowest common denominator. But when our mutual understanding and resolve and unity to act is staunchly united, then this lowest common denominator actually becomes very high. So it's the lowest, but it can be very high. So this is indeed, I think, the standard that we now have to look up to when we take future decisions in foreign and security policy. Unfortunately, we still use words and papers to express policy. One can only hope that, of course, we will deliver what we say through these words and through these papers. I think I've spent the best of my 10 minutes trying to show that the Compass is not a wish list, but rather a very concrete to-do list. And I will not repeat myself on that. The hard work, of course, for us begins now with the implementation and also with keeping this very high standard of unity and resolve to act. Our high representative said it himself, the Compass is by no means a point of arrival, but it's a point of departure. So let's see what we do with that now. Maybe just to as a thought to leave you with and to look forward to it when it comes to the Compass. No other EU strategy so far, and I've mentioned this, has been adopted by ministers, foreign and defense, and endorsed by leaders. This is the highest possible political ownership that we can have for a strategy. This is as much as we can have and we can do. So if this doesn't give us ammunition to keep people accountable and leaders and countries accountable for what they've committed to and that what they've assumed political responsibility for, then I don't know what more we can do. Of course, it's always easier to say why something won't work than find solutions to make something work. So my plea here is to work together, because the spillover of the Compass, if it is to deliver on its commitments, will go way beyond EU member states. There are concrete proposals there to support the resilience of Ukraine, of Moldova, of Georgia, of the Western Balkans, of Africa. It's about our common resilience and security and our partners' resilience and security. So I can only do my bit, show up to work, try to talk to you about this, do my bit, and hope that the Compass will deliver for the sake of European and transatlantic security. So I'm sorry I cannot stay for the rest of the discussion, but I know it is recorded and I will gladly watch it to get more of your insights. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Tanya, and for being with us despite your very, very busy schedule. So we really appreciate your contribution. Thank you. So I will open up to the other participants if you have some comments or quick reactions to some of the questions I raised before we open it up to the Q&A from the... I see Professor Gnatovsky's hand.
Yes, thank you very much, Professor Lankina, for this and for your questions. And I also had a look at the questions that are appearing in the Q&As. And so basically, your question was to me was on the responsibility of those who have committed war crimes. And there's also a question on the international institutions created after the Second World War, whether they will survive or whether they need to be transformed. I'll start with your question. That's a whole new dimension, of course, which is rarely discussed at events which deal with security as such. But I think these are important things. And what's war crimes? Certainly, there's well-known avenues. There's the International Criminal Court, which has jurisdiction for war crimes and crimes against humanity that are being committed and have been committed in the course of Russia's war on Ukraine. And one can only hope that the ICC can be sped up and can receive more support from states and more incentive to move quicker than it usually does. But there is one issue which directly relates to the issue of security, and this is the international criminal responsibility for the crime of aggression, which is that is for the violation of the foundational principles of international law, namely the prohibition on the use of force in international relations in a way which is manifestly violating the UN Charter. And there is an obvious gap in the institutional and jurisdictional landscape, and this architecture is not perfect, because since the Nuremberg trial, a similar trial in Tokyo, there hasn't been a case when the leadership of the countries, persons who could influence its policy, which led to the crime of aggression, were actually held responsible. Criminally responsible, and the efforts to set this mechanism up within the International Criminal Court have been only partially successful. And it, for example, in the Ukrainian case, the International Criminal Court will not have jurisdiction for the crime of aggression. Russia is not going to ratify the required treaties. So, which is why I think it's important to return to the experience from Nuremberg and seriously consider, and I think it should be done, to set up a special tribunal for the crime of aggression against Ukraine. Drawing on the Nuremberg's experience, this proposal has been made. It's been supported by the Ukrainian government. It's been supported by former UK prime ministers, Gordon Brown, John Major, and by leading international lawyers, also of the United Kingdom, but also from all over Europe and more globally. And this would certainly be a good idea, even if this would be a trial in absentia, which is a trial without the people present, the accused present, in front of the judges. That is also one Nuremberg experience that could be taken on board. And this brings me to the second question. I will answer very briefly, because I think the answer is contained in the question. Indeed, the UN Security Council, to remain relevant, it has to be radically transformed, because otherwise, it unfortunately makes no practical sense, and it renders the United Nations helpless in the face of such a war of aggression. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'll actually now read out some of the other questions, and thank you, Professor Gnatovsky, for kind of responding already to one of the questions in the Q&A boxes. So I'll read out the other one about, it's from William Ostatnik, and it's about Dr. Suarez's comments about developing, deterring, defending, but also prioritization of capabilities. What are the most important niche technologies, tools, capabilities, or industries where the EU already has a strong position, possibly a lead? If you could briefly answer that that question, Dr. Soar, please.
Yes, thank you. Well, I would start by saying that among the emerging and disruptive technologies that could be the underpinning of the next generation of military capabilities that could result in significant transformations of how wars are fought in the not too distant future, be it artificial intelligence, cloud and edge computing, hypersonics, quantum, further down the line, human enhancement. Europeans don't have a lead, are in the position to actually get their act together to catch up with countries like our close ally, the United States, or with countries like China, for instance, who are very much more advanced. We have been talking for the past, I believe, 6 years now about investing and increasing in the digitalization of defense in Europe, about making our capabilities, more digitally connected, more software driven, more inclined toward more built around open architectures, which could enable us to exploit to the fullest potentially information superiority over our adversaries. But we haven't necessarily done so. Over the past 2 years, we're seeing an increasing curve in European investment in sensors, in new types of sensors, which will presumably lead to greater digitalization, which will open the door for the deployment of artificial intelligence and other tools. But that is only likely to happen if we keep a steady and increasing investment in defense, in defense investment in particular, in R&D, not just in procurement. I'm afraid that on that aspect, we're not quite there as Europeans. Our investment in R&D, in research and development, and research and technology, has certainly increased since historical levels in 2008, but they are, by comparison to other great powers, they are very much low, still very much driven by national interests and national plans and national investments. That hurts the European approach, or what we've been talking about as the European added value in defense. If we don't spend together, if we don't invest together, if we don't develop these technologies together, national industrial interests are still getting in the way a little bit of that. And we're seeing that with these kind of emerging technologies. We're also seeing that with respect to some of the strategic military capabilities that will underpin our defense in the 2030s and 2040s, right? Be it the future combat air combat system or others. So I'm afraid that we're still in a catch-up phase right now with respect to these new technologies. And as I've mentioned in my introductory remarks, our need to respond to a very immediate and geographically proximate threat is limiting our options and is limiting the breathing space and the financial envelope that we have available to invest more in these technologies that will keep us competitive over the longer term. Thank you.
Thank you. There's a question on China. How do you assess EU and NATO USA / USA alignment vis-a-vis China, not only Russia, more generally? How should EU treat China and what diplomatic tools to use and apply to deter Beijing from aligning fully with Moscow, especially given the upcoming EU-China summit? Anybody would want to address that question?
Yeah, I can tell a few words if you don't mind. Obviously, China is a very important factor in this triangle. Let's call it triangle: the West, Russia, and China. And there were some rumors or information media that the Chinese government is going to provide some military or economic help or assistance to Russia during this war. What we can do basically is to communicate to Chinese government very openly that this goes against the very basic interest of China, and it's not a good idea to help Russia to bypass the sanctions, because at the end it can harm the Chinese economy too. In a long-term basis, both the EU and NATO are defining China in a very balanced way, I would say. So as a systematic rival, as a strategic competitor, but also as an opportunity there are some opportunities for partnership. So it very much depends on the strategic decision of the Chinese government, that which way they are going to define for themselves, not only in this particular war, but in general in Asia or in the Pacific region and East Asia. So it's one of the big questions which the NATO countries are dealing with, and even today in the summit, China was included in the communique. Within that framework which I was talking about.
Yeah. Thank you. I see that Dr. Suare also wanted to respond to that comment. Question.
Yes, if I can just really quickly jump in there. I think that that is really a key question about looking forward as to the dynamics between Russia and China. I wouldn't put it as an alignment of China with Russia, but rather the other way around, because I think that the economic and the macroeconomic dynamics in this binome is not necessarily pushing China closer to Russia, but increasingly pushing Russia out of necessity closer to China. And that is something that is incredibly interesting to observe, very consequential. It's something that both the US and NATO in particular have been aware of and have been trying to deter as much as possible, or to avoid. Deter is not the right term here, but to avoid as much as possible. But one of the key aspects that I see and a key difference between Russia and China is how we measure our tolerance to the risk or the threat that each presents to European security and defense. I think that NATO, for better or worse, have got it rather right, especially with the 2019 military strategy in the alliance. It's very clear. Russia is the threat, is here, is geographically proximate to us. It has an immediate manifestation and it has significant consequences. Whereas China is a threat, but the manifestation of that threat is very much different, and it might not necessarily or always require or immediately require a military response. So there we have to use tools that are perhaps more sophisticated for this kind of competition. I'm not really sure that the European Union is getting it right, though, I have to say. I think that they're still thinking that they can compete geoeconomically with China and isolate the security consequences of this competition. And of course, I don't have my crystal ball with me to tell you how this ends, but based on a historical approach to how great power competition goes, then perhaps hedging our bets a little bit more would be the wiser path to follow. Thank you.
There is a question from Faisal Rahim. How receptive do you think the US will be towards the EU's strategic compass? Should the US be concerned this move is the start of supplanting NATO as the bulwark of European defense? And I understand our speaker about the specifically who discussed compass, she's left, but I see Dr. Andrzejczak, has his hand up. So if you're happy to answer that question, please.
Yes, thank you very much. I mean, that question, that relation between EU and NATO in the field of security of defense is not new. It's with us for at least 20, 30 years, obviously. And there were different initiatives and projects and policies within the EU how to strengthen the so-called strategic autonomy. Some projects were tailored even how to create some independent non-NATO structures in the field of security and defense. Some of those structures are already existing, obviously, but the big question is not a bureaucratic one. The big question is basically how we define European security, if we define it dominate in opposition to the United States as something completely independent, or if we define it in cooperation with the United States. And I believe that even those who were trying to choose the first path, I mean, to define the European security in opposition to the US, even those representatives or experts or position, they understood now after this Russian aggression that it's not something which is desirable in Europe. Basically, NATO was really able and capable to react on the Russian aggression. NATO demonstrated basically the ability and the will of the member states to defend Central Europe. And there are many, many countries within the EU itself without any desire to compromise the transatlantic link and the position of NATO as the most important security provider in Europe. I cannot imagine a situation when somebody now is trying to weaken NATO or to strengthen EU as a security actor at the expenses of NATO. So I guess that this question is basically answered time being. NATO will stay with us, fortunately, for another decades and as a primary institution of European security. It doesn't mean, obviously, that we cannot strengthen European security. We have to and we will. It just must be complementary with the NATO. And I believe that if Europeans are stronger, the NATO is stronger in general. So to build a stronger European security identity doesn't necessarily mean that we are going to destroy NATO. We just need to do it in a way which goes absolutely hand in hand with NATO, and it's what is happening now, fortunately.
Thank you. I see Dr. Soare also wanted to respond to this question.
Just very, very quickly, I think that this is such a false dichotomy between the choice between the European Union and NATO, for especially for member states who are participating in both. And we only have, I mean, there's a thing, right, to say there's a single set of forces for the defense of Europe and the transatlantic alliance, and that is true. You can't split them between NATO and the European Union, and member states still have full sovereign ownership over those forces and over the capabilities. So the issue is to look at NATO and the European Union as platforms and tools for the member states as to where they can better cooperate on specific issues. Now, NATO and the European Union are respectively better placed to address certain issues. NATO is not as well placed as the European Union to deal with geoeconomic and statecraft tools to fight, to counteract hybrid threats. It's good on cyber defense, it's good on territorial defense, it's good on exercising, it's good on standardization of our military capabilities. So pushing through those strengths that each institution has and recognizing them is not a matter of competition between the two. Ultimately, the result is that Europeans and the members of the transatlantic community are hopefully more secure together. But in addition to this, to answer the question in the chat from our audience, is how responsive will the US be to the EU strategic compass? Well, hopefully it will be, but it will be responsive. It will have a positive response. But, you know, this takes me back to what Professor Lankana was saying at the beginning of our Q&A, is we have all been surprised by the a firm reaction that the European Union has put up in response to the invasion of Ukraine, the second invasion of Ukraine. I'm sure that our partners across the Atlantic are feeling that effect of surprise. I'm not sure how effective we are as a major geopolitical player if our partners, even our partners, are surprised by our behavior. This should be the staple of that geopolitical behavior rather than the exception. So hopefully they'll respond positively to the strategic compass, but one cannot erase 2 decades, 3 decades now of concern in Washington that Europeans are still underinvesting in defense, that they are underinvesting in new technologies, that they are underinvesting in the training and exercising and the readiness of their troops for situations just like this.
Thank you. We have a question which appears to be a repeat question, although I didn't see it earlier in the Q&A box. Perhaps the Slovak ambassador could answer why ex-Soviet jets and S-300 air defense system have not been supplied yet, why NATO acting scared by the imagined nuclear threat, ways to provide humanitarian aid through quoting responsibility to protect. These questions be discussed, please? I don't know if somebody wants to.
Yes, if I may, there's a question about Slovakia potentially giving those S-300s air defense systems to Ukraine. We declared several times, and we are declaring it all the time, that we are ready to provide those capabilities to Ukraine. We just need to have something which is going to replace it. I mean, obviously we were supplying already Ukraine with with air defense missiles. Not S-300 because it's more like longer range, obviously. But simply we need to think also about our own security. And I understand that for somebody it can be selfish, but the case is that we can provide those systems and we declared it. Our representatives basically several times they declared it openly. We just need to manage somehow the replacement. I mean, to get somehow a system, an air defense system, which has the same or similar or comparable capability, in order to keep our airspace protected, basically. So this is the answer. I believe that those negotiations are still ongoing, and as we mentioned many times, we are absolutely ready to help, and we want to help Ukrainians.
Thank you. We have 2 minutes remaining, so I wanted to ask perhaps briefly the panelists if they want to say a kind of brief comments to wrap up the discussion before I think the system will cut us out automatically in 2 minutes' time. So just very briefly, if you want to give some final sort of reflections, something that questions that haven't come up that you wanted to address.
Yes, very briefly. Thank you very much, Professor Lankina. There was another question on why NATO is scared with the imagined nuclear threat. And I would like to know the answer myself, because I think that getting this threat the way it is taken now will lead us nowhere, because it will just lead to more concessions and to graver problems. But that's my perspective on this. Once again, thank you very much for this excellent event, and I learned a lot today. Thank you.
Thank you. Any final reflections from the other panelists before I also thank everybody for a really, really stimulating and thought-provoking discussion. I don't see any more hands. So before we were cut off, I think there was also a reminder from the organizers that there will be a feedback form that participants are invited to complete, or guests to this event. But meanwhile, I wanted to thank everybody very much for finding the time in this really, really hectic. I know from my own experience that, you know, I've been going from talk to talk, and it's extremely demanding and challenging also, not just intellectually, but emotionally for all of us as we are witnessing this these horrific crimes and events unfolding before our eyes. So thank you very much for joining us in this event. Thank you.
And thank you, Professor Lankina, for your expert moderation. Thank you so much. Thank you to the other panelists as well.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.